Welcome to the Drill Down. We've got business stories behind stocks on the move. I'm Corey Johnson. Today, September 22nd, is episode 101. It's 101. That's a lot. All right, well, just ahead, Adobe tells a tale about the future of marketing. Is anyone listening? And Stitch Fix tries to convince us that bloated inventories just don't matter anymore. And maybe they're right. And from furniture to cryptocurrencies, the reinvention of Overstock.com. Yes, the same company that once accused me of being a tool of a global conspiracy and a foot soldier of the Sith Lord. I kid you not, we're going to talk to the CEO of Overstock, and hell yeah, I'm going to bring that all up. But first, it's sponsor time.
The Drill Down is brought to you by Era. Never miss another critical event or insight ever. With Era, customize your company watch list and track key events, mentions, filings, and more, all within an easy-to-use, customizable interface. That's Era, A-I-E-R-A.com.
And we hope you found a way to make the Drill Down a part of your daily routine. Maybe it's a commute. Maybe it's a dog walk. Maybe you're listening to it on your smart speaker. Try that. Say, hey, Alexa, play the Drill Down podcast. Make sure you subscribe and listen to the Drill Down every day.
And the Drill Down is brought to you by Braintrust, a global talent network that matches highly skilled technical freelancers with the world's most reputable brands. Braintrust has helped clients like Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, Porsche, Under Armour, and more build agile tech teams fast at a fraction of the cost. Visit Braintrust.com, that's Braintrust.com, to learn more.
All right, welcome to the Drill Down. I'm Corey Johnson. We've got the business stories behind stocks on the move, and we've got executive producer Isaac Webster. So happy about that. And he's got a whole lot, including three most important developments in the world of business today.
Here we go. Corey, we got to start with the Fed in the room, the Fed. The Federal Reserve signaling it could start reversing its pandemic stimulus programs in November and could raise interest rates next year. The Fed's next scheduled meeting is November 2nd through the 3rd. So we will see. And big news today.
Yeah, I mean, I think we saw it coming, but sure.
We saw it coming. Isn't that song, They Saw It Coming? They saw it coming.
Don't sing. Please don't
from
sing.
Chicago. From Chicago, the musical, right?
I don't know.
Oh, come on. All right. Anyway, so everyone's been waiting for this Fed news, and we got it today, and now we'll see what happens in November. Number two, the U.S. housing market cooled some in August. Existing home sales dropped 2% from the prior month as buyers pulled back. Supply tightened and prices eased, as we've been talking about. And August sales also fell 1.5% compared to a year earlier. Now, all this is according to the National Association of Realtors.
And that's the number of sales, not the prices. And we heard that from Lennar yesterday, when Lennar told us they could have sold more if they could have made more. They just couldn't get the product completed. They couldn't get land acquisitions done. So this falls right in line with what we've been hearing.
Now, isn't that another song? Coulda, woulda, shoulda, da, da, da. No, that's not right. Okay, let's move on. Now, we're going to stay. We're having too much fun. It's our 101 episode. Hey.
Just wait. Now,
yeah, I know, right? No. Now, mortgage lender Loan Depot is alleged to have cut corners in an echo of the 2008 crisis. That's what an ex-executive is saying. A lawsuit by Loan Depot's former operations chief says that as Loan Depot prepared to go public, its founder pushed workers to approve mortgages without documentation. Now, if you don't know this, Loan Depot, and I was not aware of Loan Depot before this story, Loan Depot is one of the mortgage industry's biggest non-bank lenders. So very interesting developments here.
It's always a telltale sign of what companies are doing right at the end of a quarter, or especially right before an IPO, and the way they make changes in their business processes to make the numbers look good to sell the stock. It's worrisome.
What are they doing? Okay, right. That's the last time I'm going to sing. I'm sorry. Weird episode. Sorry about that. Corey, what stocks are you drilling down on today?
Let's start with that giant software company, Adobe.
Adobe. I think I've heard of it. ADBE is how it trades. Shares fell today, but they've gained 28% in a year, just underperforming the S&P 500 over the past 12 months.
Yeah, that's not great. You'd think a company in the world of digital anything would be exceeding everything in the last year, exceeding the S&P 500. And the stock performance has not, but the company has. They put up a quarter that they announced today that was, I thought, super strong across most metrics. As you mentioned, shares down a little bit today, whatever. The thing that I got a better understanding about today that I had not had before was something with a horrible name, the Adobe Experience Platform. Sounds like a stage for Jimi Hendrix.
Or it sounds like a tent at Coachella.
Right, like right. The experience platform.
That's where I would hang out.
With Lady Gaga. And yeah, yeah. So the experience platform apparently is a marketing platform. But I got a cogent explanation of it finally from CEO Shantanu Narayen, who I think is terrific. And Shantanu Narayen talked about the experience, and it doesn't matter what kind of company you're in, what kind of business, all of our listeners, they could be in oil and gas, they could be in healthcare, they could be in technology, they could be in media, whatever. Whatever business you're in, you've watched this happen, where the first technology in your business was a website. And the next thing was trying to figure out what was going on the website with analytics. And then it moved on to more. And maybe you start to think about marketing messages, and that a digital marketing platform was a table stakes in during the pandemic, and a presence and commerce and data and insights into that data and analytics for that data. That's just where you start. And these guys making the case, Shantanu Narayen in particular, making the case in their conference call that what might have started with a website and went to analytics is now taking the marketing message all the way through with a profile of the customer, understanding the behavioral data of that customer, collecting it in real time, giving a marketing message to those people to keep them engaged with your product. And whether it's, you know, consumer businesses, the healthcare industry, he says they're all starting to use this Adobe Experience Platform. Interesting case from CEO Shantanu Narayen.
I think everybody started with a website. Everybody started with the analytics. But I think where we've delivered the Adobe Experience Platform and what we are talking about, our personalization, I think that's a key differentiator. And, you know, whether you're a B2B company or a B2C company, you just have to invest in this particular business. And I think the team's done a particularly good job, both of messaging in different industries. The healthcare industry, for example, continues to do well, and there's more interest associated with that. The consumer businesses are starting to see a little bit of a comeback as, you know, there's a little bit more normalcy. And so, you know, a lot of them, we're going after existing customers, we're going after new logos and, you know, selling more. But I would say it's the strength of the experience platform, the ability to have these profiles, the behavioral data that we're collecting in real time, the marketing message associated with telling them that they really need to focus on getting their first party data to be an asset that they could put on their balance sheet, and the nature of what's happening with digital commerce. I think all of those are trends.
And indeed, trends that all kinds of businesses are starting to look at and understand that acceleration towards digital transformation.
Drink.
The digital transformation of all kinds of companies starts to follow that, where they're really following their consumers across all the things that they do, or at least they want to.
Corey, what is your next drill down?
Let's look at Stitch Fix.
Stitch Fix. Stitch Fix trades under SFIX, SFIX. Shares rose almost 16% today, and they've gained 30% in a year. What's going on with Stitch Fix?
So Stitch Fix has maintained from the early days, thanks to a very concerted marketing effort, not least, is that they're not a clothing retailer at all. That in fact, they are a technology company, and they've commanding technology margins. And they insist that we're a technology platform, we can customize what people want for clothing, we're a marketing platform, we can figure out who our customers are and how they'll keep buying from us, and our technology will lead us to succeed in ways that retailers never could. I don't know if I buy it, but as you mentioned, the stock's done just fine, up a ton when they announced revenues yesterday for the most recent quarter, up 29% year over year, $571 million. Just a fantastic quarter for these guys. Looks like they're going to do $2 billion this year in the trailing year. And now they grew clients big time, 18% increase in clients to 4.2 million clients. Revenue per active client up 4% to $505. So the average client order is $505, or at least for the whole quarter. Super impressive growth with women's, growth with kids, growth in the UK, and growth in inventory. Now, back in the day when I was a short seller, there was one consistent metric above all others that showed a company was about to have a problem, and it was when the inventory went up. Stitch Fix inventory went up by $87 million, Now, they have launched a new program called Stitch Fix Freestyle. I mentioned that because you're going to hear it in the soundbite in a second where the CEO talks about it in passing. But with Freestyle, you're buying stuff that Stitch Fix has in inventory. They're not just ordering just in time or whatever, ordering from other providers. They've already bought the stuff. They own the stuff. They think they can ship it out to you faster and fill the orders faster without getting stuck with the inventory, which is always the problem in inventory. And maybe they're right. Inventory compared to last quarter for this company was flat, but that's a lot bigger than what it was a year ago in COVID. And guess what? People can't get inventory these days. Maybe it's the smart move right now, but the number of inventory turns for this company is going to go up compared to the old numbers. And like I said, historically, that's been nothing but a bad signal for most companies. Still, CEO John Jaffe saying the quarter on quarter, they're flat, and year on year, yeah, it's going to go up because things are different now.
Quarter on quarter, we're flat, and you're right, year on year. Of course, a year ago, inventory was in a precarious position for us simply due to COVID. So that's probably not the right comparable. We did buy in advance of supply chain to some extent. We're also increasing selection, as Elizabeth said, and we're going to continue to increase that selection going forward. And looking for the rest of the year, we probably won't be back to historical turns that we normally would see. And that's, again, because we're very focused on increasing the selection for Freestyle. That being said, I think by the time, in the back half of the year, we're targeting more that 4 to 5 on a turns basis. But again, it's very dependent on the selection we bring in.
So, I'm going to keep an eye on this one. This might be the only time in history that having a lot of inventory was really good for a business because you just can't get product to sell. I say the only time in history, but the only time lately because of the problems shipping in the world. But we'll see.
Corey, what is your next drill down?
FedEx, once known as Federal Express.
FedEx. Trades under FDX. Shares fell 9% today, and they've declined 5% over the past 12 years, or I'm sorry, 12 months. Declined 5% over the past 12 months. Right. Yeah, I mean, the last year has felt like 12 years. But yeah, 5% decline in a year for FedEx. What's going on here?
So they reported quarterly numbers, and the numbers were, pretty good. I mean, the very strong demand, very strong pricing conditions for them, really as good as they've been in a long time. Revenues are $22 billion at 14%. You think that'd be a really good thing for this company, but their profits fell. I'm going to use operating income because there's a lot of weird things that come in their income statement below that. But operating income fell from $1.6 billion a year ago to $1.5 billion this time around. And their operating margins, of course, obviously, declined from 8.2% to 6.8%. So operating margins are going down. More revenue, and yet profits falling substantially. And they just didn't do a great job managing inflation in their business. And their other cost growth, not just labor, but they had a 9% cost growth if you take out labor costs. That was worrisome, not least of which because they're going into their big season when they've got to hire a lot of people. Now, they think that they will be able to hire all of the people that they need, 90,000 people in the fourth calendar quarter, because that's what they need to get through the holidays. Even though every company out there is telling us, it's hard to forget raising pay. Yeah, you got to raise pay, but just getting the people is really hard.
90,000 people, where all here in the U.S. or is that across the globe?
I think it's everywhere. But regardless, that's a lot of people to hire, conditions are very hard.
Yeah, that's a tall order.
Saying it's not just expensive, but you just can't find the people to do that. We know that there are more, thanks to the JOLTS data, that there are more open jobs. Thanks to the Labor Department's JOLTS report that comes out every month, there are more open jobs than there are people available to fill them. So even if you took every unemployed person and gave them a job, there'd still be open jobs, even if they had those skills. FedEx, however, is saying things are getting a little bit easier. Now, Wall Street doesn't believe them, but here's the chief operating officer, Rajesh Sumaram, and he has got a take that, things are getting easier. We're going to be able to get all the people that we need.
The last 2 weeks, we have seen pockets of opportunity and, positive changes that we hadn't seen in the first quarter. So that gives us a little bit of encouragement. And this is a systemic issue. And so, yes, we're making some assumptions here in terms of labor availability. But if we staff up for peak, then, you know, hopefully we, you know, the Q3 will be in good shape. So we're making, you know, we're not making dramatic assumptions here in terms of Q3 and Q4, but we are assuming that Q3 is going to be better than Q2, is going to be better than Q1. And the early indication, just very early indication, is that that's indeed the case.
Now, on one level, you'd think they would know, but if you look at the results they just put up where their operating margin declined by so much, maybe they don't know. All right, well, coming up, Overstock.com. Can't believe we're talking to these guys because they once suggested that I was a tool of a global conspiracy trying to take down the company. Well, I'm going to talk to Overstock CEO Jonathan Johnson about that nuttiness and maybe more importantly, the new look at Overstock.com. But first,
The Drill Down is brought to you by Brain Trust, a global talent network that matches highly skilled technical freelancers with the world's most reputable brands. Brain Trust has helped clients like Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, Porsche, Under Armour, and more build agile tech teams fast at a fraction of the cost. Visit braintrust.com, that's BRAINTRUST.com, to learn more.
And The Drill Down is brought to you by Indeed. When you pay for a job site, you should know what you're getting. Get Indeed and pay only for the quality candidates who meet your must-have requirements. Don't just hope for the perfect candidate. Indeed's hiring tools help you cut through the noise and hire faster and smarter. With Indeed assessments, you can choose from 135 skill tests. Make sure you're finding applications for people with the skills that you need. According to Talent Nest, Indeed delivers 4 times more hires than all other job sites combined, and 1.5 times more hires than even internal referrals. So join more than 3 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Get started right now. Drill Down listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to upgrade their job post at Indeed.com/drilldown. That's right, a $75 credit at Indeed.com/drilldown. That's Indeed.com/drilldown. Offer valid through September 30. Terms and conditions apply. All right, welcome back to the Drill Down podcast. We are joined right now by Jonathan Johnson. No relation. He is the CEO of Overstock, a company we've followed. It's been through a lot of changes over the years. Overstock today is not what Overstock was in the past. But Jonathan, when you took over, I think you said something to the effect of, in your first conference call, we're doing 20 things, none of them well. What are the things that you are doing right now? Because from the results, it looks like they're going well.
Well, we're focused first and primarily on being an e-commerce company that provides dream homes for all. We're at home furnishings, we're at home furniture. That's what we're focused on. Overstock over the years has morphed from being a liquidator to a general merchandiser to what we are today, an online home furnishings company. We are also less focused on our blockchain investments. We've outsourced those to a venture capital firm, which runs them well. We expect they will make money and we'll make money on that together. But we're focused on being an e-commerce company.
So let's talk about that. So home furnishings, the business has really, really changed in the last, I'm going to call it 10 years. I spent a lot of time researching in the furniture business, probably like 07, 08. That was kind of my housing bubble play back then was furnishing. I probably should have been short Lehman Brothers instead, but note to self. But leverage works both ways, right? But what we've seen in the furnishing business is, I would say the two biggest changes in the last, again, 10, 12 years has been movement towards manufacturing in Asia for everything, not just the big case goods. So a lot cheaper stuff as a result. And purchasing online. You guys in your earnings presentation last time around said that a third of all home furnishings were purchased online last year.
Yeah, there's a real secular shift. And pre-pandemic, that shift from brick and mortar to online was probably occurring 1-2% a year. And pre-pandemic, it was at about 23% of home furnishing products were purchased online. Now it's mid-30s. It got as high as 42% during the pandemic. And I think that's changed for two reasons. One, people were forced to try it during the pandemic and found that it was pretty easy. And second, the technology has just improved, whether it's augmented reality or virtual reality and seeing product in your space, whether it's the increased video and descriptions that are online. It's a lot easier to purchase furniture today than it was a decade ago.
Yeah, I had a conversation with some friends at Unity, the video game engine maker, at least I would have described them as such, and yet what they told me is that they're actually having a lot of sales, and indeed even the companies that make furniture, to sort of show how you can use a 3D gaming engine to imagine furniture in your room. That kind of thing was unimaginable even a few years ago.
Yeah, and you know, we're exploring things like that too. Technology just makes things easier. And then, you know, expectations change. You know, two decades ago, no one could imagine buying books online. Today, if we buy physical books at all, it's always online. A decade ago, people thought, oh, you'll never be able to sell clothes or apparel online because of color and size and fit. Today, that's how most clothing's purchased. And that's where we're going. I think there's been this secular shift in home furnishings, and it's been great for Overstock.
And you couldn't have had a better sort of environment for, you know, I'll give you some credit, say you were ready for this change. But with the pandemic, you really did have, as you said, people kind of forced to shop online. But you also had improved balance sheets. The stimulus program seemed to have worked if the goal was to put money into pockets and have people spend that money. And so they spent that money in their homes because they were cooped up in their homes. And you guys were just right in the right place at the right time. But I wonder, what do you see in terms of lasting behavior and how that's affecting Overstock?
Yeah, so we were in the middle of a turnaround before the pandemic started. We'd gone from having 27 key initiatives, which was like having no key initiatives, to 4 really focused on what we were doing.
27 key initiatives.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, it's an oxymoron. And so we really got focused. And I think the pandemic, as this tidal wave of business came in, hid the fact of some fundamental operational improvements we've made. And Warren Buffett has often said, only when the tide goes out do you discover who's been swimming naked.
I don't know, my listeners know that that's my favorite Buffett quote because I say it all the time.
Well, that's good. That's good. And we had this tidal wave of pandemic-inspired business. And now that we've kind of lapped the beginning of that, Overstock is still growing. And I think it's because we've made fundamental operational improvements. While many of our competitors, their year-over-year results, they're shrinking. And so I like to say the tide's gone out, and it's clear that Overstock is wearing an operational wetsuit. We're not swimming naked. We've spent time improving our business, and it's showing in the results.
I wonder, too, though, what is, and I'll agree with you, it looks like the results are still tight and afloat, but I wonder how much is about changing consumer behavior. If consumers, for example, will continue to not go to furniture stores to buy the furniture that they want, the industry used to believe you had to get a butt and a seat to sell the seat. Obviously, some of that changed out of necessity, but you wonder if there are permanent long-term changes. Similarly, individual balance sheets are so much stronger than they've maybe ever been.
Yeah, so individual balance sheets are strong. I mean, people's savings rates are high. I do think the furniture business is in a macroeconomic good place. Work from home and hybrid is not going to stop, and people are going to spend more time in their homes and more time on their home furnishings. People are expanding their living spaces from the 4 walls of their homes to the 4 corners of their property. People used to think you couldn't sell clothes online. You can, and you can sell furniture, and we're proving it can be done. And I think this shift to online is still growing. You know, when it's mature, will it be 40% or 60% or, you know, somewhere in between or somewhere greater? We'll wait and see. But people value convenience. And I think particularly once you've done something online and found that it's easy, rarely do you go back to doing it. Frankly, furniture shopping is not fun, going to a big box store and walking around. But when you can scroll through millions of products online quickly and find what you need quickly, furnishing your home can be a lot of fun.
Arcus, let's get to that. Find what you need. The woes we are hearing about importing anything go across every single industry we can imagine and some we can't. I wonder what, but one of the first ones you got to think about is furniture. What are you seeing? How is it impacting you? How is it impacting margins?
Yeah, so the supply chain for the past 18 months has had kinks in it at different places. At the beginning of the pandemic, it was the manufacturers themselves were shut down in China. And many of our suppliers moved to Thailand and Vietnam and other places. Then there was a kink in the delivery from the warehouse to the consumer. UPS and FedEx were overbooked. In the last fourth quarter, everyone was fearing what was called Shipageddon. We got around Shipageddon by having accurate forecasts. Our sales had been high for months ahead of the fourth quarter that we could say, look, here's what we expect. Please have your trucks at our suppliers' warehouses. And they did. Today, the real kink in the supply chain is the cost of freight across the ocean. And so we're working with our very distributed supplier base to help them consolidate containers, try and get value for them there. But overstock has fared well throughout because we have such a distributed supply chain. We have nearly 4,000 partners, that's what we call our suppliers, that sell goods on our site. So if one is out of a mid-century modern black leather sofa, another usually has it. So we've done well, even with a tough supply chain.
So you were saying about what's going on with containers right now. And when the price, none of the prices we've heard are crazy. I mean, you know, cost of a container from China to the Port of Long Beach goes from $1,000 to $20,000 in some cases in the course of a year. What are you doing about that?
Well, we're working with our supplier partners to try and help them consolidate. You know, today it's just getting a container is hard. And so when we work together with our partner suppliers to help them, one, locate containers, and two, consolidate in case they have less than a full container load of stuff, it creates synergies that are helping our business and helping theirs.
And it's what's the very latest you're seeing in that? Is it the same as it was 2 weeks ago? I mean, presumably you're managing it on that kind of a daily basis.
Daily basis. You know, the containers remain expensive. The ports are beginning to be less clogged. You know, for a while, the ports outside of the Pacific Ocean outside of Long Beach and Los Angeles looked like the 405 freeway. I mean, they were just jammed up, but those are running much smoother now.
No, I see in the Port of Oakland too. I see that the ships, our studio is right here in the San Francisco Ferry Building. So we look out in the window, look out into the bay and can see the ships stacked up. It's fascinating to see that kind of volume.
And we've helped our suppliers change from going into Los Angeles and Long Beach to going into Oakland or Seattle. We've been very active in trying to find the least kinked part of the supply chain.
What a fascinating business to be in. I suppose it also allows, well, you've got, if the container cost is up that much, you've got to be able to raise your prices. You've got a need to raise your prices if you're going to keep gross margins where you have kept them.
Well, you know, we do have a low gross margin business. We run kind of in the 22%-ish range for gross margins. As the cost of manufacturing, as the cost of labor and shipping and containers, and even the cost of raw materials has gone up, we've worked hard with our partners to have them share a part of the cost. We share a part of the cost. We're really trying not to push it to our customers, particularly as there's this secular shift to online purchasing. We kind of view this as the Oklahoma land rush. Customers are discovering online. We want them to see the smart value that we offer. And so we work really hard to keep the price down to the extent we can.
So let's talk about your blockchain stuff. I'm conversant in the world of blockchain. Overstock there's nothing Overstock could do that would surprise me at this point after all these decades of covering Overstock. But you guys were deeply involved in blockchain in some, I would say, I'm just going to say odd ways. You say you farmed that out to a venture capital firm, but you maintain ownership over the firm. Explain to me what, give me the history there and tell me where we are in that.
Overstock has been and is bullish on blockchain technology. We really think it's going to change the world, just like the internet changed the world four decades ago. We have investments in 21 different companies that are using blockchain technology in areas like capital markets, central banking, voting, supply chain, all kinds of areas. When I became the CEO of Overstock, I had been president of our blockchain division. And when I started looking for a replacement for that president's role, I realized that these companies had matured to a place where they needed just the kind of services that venture capital firms provide. Greater management oversight, greater product to market oversight, help in funding. And so what we did is we created a limited partnership. We're the sole limited partner, and Pelion Ventures, a venture capital firm, is the general partner that manages that. And as each of those portfolio companies has exits, Overstock will be the beneficiary as the sole limited partnership and as the, you know, keeping our ownership interest in those companies. And Pelion will have some economic reward too. So I think it's set up in a very nice economic structure so that we do, Pelion does better when we do better.
I was really struck by the announcement about Bit Incorporated, whatever, and whatever the actual title of the company is, but the announcement that Nigeria was going to create the Inaria, a digital currency in Nigeria based on this technology that your company or your venture firm owns, seems like it's a massive opportunity. There's a giant, just because of, full disclosure, once upon a time I worked for a company called Ripple that was very involved in the world of remittances and spends a lot of time and has what I think is great software and a great technology to allow for cheap, quick, safe remittances. A country like Nigeria that has so much remittances part of their GDP, and maybe we'll save that number for our bite later, but that seems like it's a great opportunity.
Yeah, we think it's huge. So Bit is in the business of helping central banks issue digital currency. It's done it in the Eastern Caribbean Central Bank, which is an economic union of eight different countries in the Caribbean. It's the second largest economic union in the world after the EU. And it recently announced that it's doing it for the Nigerian Central Bank, as you mentioned. One of the reasons I think this is so important is in Africa, in Nigeria, and you know, other countries in Africa, so much of the population is unbanked. They have jobs, they pay, you know, their utility bills, they do everything that you and I do that's necessary to get a bank account, but they don't have a bank account. And without a bank account, they don't really live in the 21st century where they have digital currency like you and I do with a credit card or a debit card. As the Central Bank of Nigeria issues a digital currency, anyone with a smartphone, and by the way, even in developing countries, that's almost
everyone.
Everybody.
Yeah.
In fact, many people have two smartphones, even if they don't have a bank account. Now they can enter the 21st century, participate with digital currency in what you and I do every day. They can start buying things online. They can pay their bills online. They can be paid online. They're not keeping their fortune in a coffee can in their sock drawer. They're keeping it in a safe and secure digital wallet.
Which isn't a joke. I mean, that is the way immigrants lived in this country, not, you know, 100 years ago, with literally no access to banks. Banks that is why we have Bank of America today. It started off as Bank of Italy, and it started off as Bank of Italy because A.P. Giannini in North Beach in San Francisco knew that his friends and, you know, the business people couldn't get bank accounts, were keeping money literally in sock drawers and buried in cans in the backyard. And I think it's hard to understand the importance of digital currencies if you're in the first world. You just don't know how bad banking is until you've gone through it.
Yeah, I mean, it's 90% of Africans don't have a bank account. And what Nigeria is, the largest populated country in Africa, is doing is they're trailblazing a way that I think most of the countries will follow. And Bit is helping them do that. And Overstock owns a significant majority interest in Bit. And so it's it's something that is going to, I think, is going to bring significant shareholder value to Overstock shareholders over time.
Let me ask you finally, Overstock has been a controversial company. I know people throw up broadcasters who are controversial and they don't know what they're talking about. I try to not do that. In this case, this is kind of personal because your company, many years ago, CEO Patrick Byrne came up with this conspiracy theory that was evolved and published. And indeed, he came up with this conspiracy theory that included me and very specifically called me out as part of this global conspiracy of investors and short sellers and journalists and the Sith Lord. I'm not exaggerating. He literally called himself out the Sith Lord was running this operation to take down Overstock. Indeed, I had a trepidation about doing this interview at all today because of my personal history with this company where this person, CEO, came out of the blue. Your predecessor came out of the blue to attack me and lots of other credible people with this very weird conspiracy theory. To be clear, I've never been short Overstock, neither have I been at a firm that's been short Overstock. This stuff was just weird. And I think it leaves a stain on your company. It's certainly with Wall Street. I wonder what your experience of that history is.
So, I've been with the company for 19 years. I certainly know that history. I also know that we're a publicly traded company and we have to participate in the public markets. And since becoming the CEO, we've done a follow-on offering, a very successful one, a little over a year ago. We've had more analysts, sell-side analysts, pick up coverage on us. That's very positive. I think everyone of the 8 analysts that's covering us has a buy or an overperform on us. We do investor conferences. We do non-deal roadshows where we know that as a public company, we have a duty to keep our shareholders informed of what we're doing. We've changed the shareholder base, which when I became CEO was roughly a third institutional shareholders, so very high retail shareholder base. To today, it's over 3/4 institutional shareholders. I think the street has seen that we're a new Overstock and that we're participating in the community. We're growing. Investors are flocking to us, and it shows not just in our operational results, but in how the results of what the market has done is we've been a big winner over the past year.
And what's your view to those who are short the stock?
Look, Overstock's never had an issue with short sellers. We had an issue with people that were trying to manipulate the stock by shorting it without borrowing and ultimately not delivering on their short sale. Look, there are going to be people that think differently than I do and will think we'll do worse than I think we'll do, and they have the right to short the stock, and good for them. I will note that one of the companies, blockchain companies that we've invested in, it's a company called T0, which, if you're in the trading business, the trades settle on trade plus 2 days or T plus two. We think blockchain technology allows trades to settle immediately or T plus zero, thus the name T0. So short selling is, can provide liquidity. We just need to make sure that it's done in a way that is fair and the trades settle quickly.
Yeah, I think any real short seller would agree with that. Yeah. Really appreciate your time. Jonathan Johnson, again, no relation. We don't have a funk band called the Brothers Johnson. We ought to, though, Jonathan, I think. What more would you want as two white guys running a funk band?
Yeah, all I know is as someone who's completely tone deaf, that would be one funky band.
Indeed. Thank you very much for your time. Appreciate it. Overstock CEO Jonathan Johnson. Coming up next, the drill down bite, that one number that tells us a whole lot. We're going to have that GDP percentage of Nigeria that is remittances. It is a huge part of one of the biggest economies in the world. We'll have that percentage. It'll blow your socks off when the drill down continues.
The drill down is brought to you by Era. With Era, give yourself an information advantage. Connect directly to earnings calls and other investor events with live transcription and event intelligence. That's Era, AIERA.com.
And the drill down is now available on Listen Notes. Go to listennotes.com. You can check out our podcast or whatever platform you're already listening to the podcast on. But if you do so, why don't you leave a review? Let the rest of the world know what it is that you like about the drill down.
And let us know what companies you think we should be drilling down on. Talk to us on Twitter and Instagram by following at Drill Down Pod, and connect with us directly on our website, bizpod.net.
All right, we're back with the Drill Down Bite, that one number that tells us a whole lot. According to PricewaterhouseCoopers, in 2018, remittances in Nigeria were 6.1% of the gross domestic product of Nigeria. So there's your bite, that one number that tells us a whole lot. Wow. 6.1% of GDP. That's one of the biggest economies in the world, 25th, 24th largest economy, depending on how you're counting it. That's $25 billion U.S. dollars being remitted to and fro across Nigerian borders. And, you know, again, as you heard from the Oversock CEO, that we've got an opportunity to have that a lot cheaper, a lot faster, a lot more accurate for people that just don't have bank accounts, and would be nothing but good for the Nigerian economy.
Yeah, it just seems like it's such, that is the growth opportunity right now.
All right, you've been listening to The Drill Down. We do appreciate your time. I'm Corey Johnson. Isaac Webster is our executive producer. Ben Wilson is our editor extraordinaire. Drill Down is a production of the Business Podcast Network.